Lecture 24, Values and Words in the 19th and 20th Centuries.
Hello, and welcome to the 19th century, the world of Victorian values, the world of the Oxford English Dictionary, the world of historical philology. In this lecture, the concluding lecture to a second set of lectures in this series on the history of the English language, I'd like to look in detail at some of the origins of the Oxford English Dictionary. But in addition to that, I want to look at some of the ideologies, some of the social and political attitudes that evolve in 19th century England that still inform our discussions of language today. The legacy of the Oxford English Dictionary is not just to be found in the way in which it defines words, it's to be found in the way in which it defines our way of speaking about words and their meanings. The Oxford English Dictionary has its origins in philology. You'll remember from my lectures on Indo-European that the 19th century in Europe and in England was the period of diachronic or historical philology, the inquiry into word origins by looking not just at their etymologies, but at the social and cultural resonances of word histories. In 1842, in England, a group met to found the Philological Society of London. And in the founding document of the Philological Society, it was stated that their goal would be, quote, for the investigation of the structure, the affinities, and the history of languages, and the philological illustration of the classical writers of Greece and Rome. The Philological Society has as its origin a sense of structure and affinity, of language history as cultural history. And one of the great products of the Philological Society was a new interest in editing texts and in developing dictionaries. Now, let me say a little bit about social attitudes towards philology in the 19th century in England. I could do this in many ways. I could talk about the details of university life. I could talk about historical philologists in particular. But I like to give a more familiar literary example. The figure of the Reverend Casaubon in Middlemarch is an excellent example for those of us who know the novel or are familiar with its refractions in contemporary movies or television to understand just what's going on in the first third or so of the 19th century in England. Casaubon thinks he's got a key to all mythologies. He has a sense in which he's understanding the world by looking at different mythological traditions or different linguistic traditions. He's a country house philologist. He has no university appointment. But in the course of this novel, Casaubon is derided by the figure of the new German philology. Casaubon is told, in effect, the Germans have already done this. And what this means in a book set in the period 1828-1830, what this means is that the Germans have developed Indo-European historical philology. The business of being a historian of language and a historian of culture is not the business of being a country house amateur. It's the business of being a university professor. It's the business not of looking at the key to all mythologies, but the key to word roots, to Indo-European, and to the systematic, scientific, and empirical study of etymology. The Philological Society is founded in order, as it were, to bring English historical linguistics into line with some of these Germanic and university traditions. And in 1864, the Early English Text Society was founded in order to recover, edit, and publish editions of early English writings. The Early English Text Society, in fact, is still going on, and they've published somewhere between 300 and 400 volumes, and more are still coming out, editions of Old and Middle English works. The Early English Text Society was founded in part to provide accurate and manageable published editions of the texts which would form the basis for the early quotations in the Oxford English Dictionary. But before looking at the OED itself, there's a couple of other stories that I want to tell. A story about Casaubon, a story about a country house philologist who loses out to Germanic university figures, and a story about a Germanic university philologist who comes to dominate English historical philology in the mid-19th century. And this is a man named Max Müller, who lived from 1823 to 1900. Max Müller was the arbiter of language in England. It was, in fact, a kind of joke among Oxford dons in the mid-19th century that any letter addressed to the professor of language, Oxford University, would go to Max Müller without any further detail. It was like almost writing to Santa Claus at the North Pole. These letters would be delivered. Max Müller's work raises some important questions about the power of language and about the relationship of language and social identity. Max Müller represents the importation of Germanic historical linguistics, a fascination with Indo-European, with word roots, with etymologies, into the English university structure. He influenced English language study for over half a century. Max Müller wrote that man had studied every part of nature, the mineral treasures in the bowels of earth, he said. And he goes on, the flowers, the animals, the heavenly bodies. He's analyzed every substance and dissected every organism. And yet, Max Müller says, language, without the aid of which not even the first step in this glorious career could have been made, has remained unnoticed. And he says, like a veil that hung too close over the eye of the human mind, it was hardly perceived. One of the themes of this course, as I've reiterated, is how we talk about language, the metaphors and images, very often organic metaphors or images. In this little snippet of Max Müller's lectures that I've read to you, Müller is talking about now language not just as a natural phenomenon, but as a university discipline. What are the university disciplines? Geology, astronomy, chemistry, botany, all of the descriptive disciplines that taxonomize the world. One makes classifications of minerals, classifications of plants, classifications of animals. Now, for Müller, we need to make classifications of languages. Language should proceed in its disciplinary course along the same lines as other disciplines, as other university courses of study. And Müller was very much involved in the way in which the study of individual words created or gave access to the history of a culture. What's unique about the Victorian attitude towards language? What's the result of this confluence of figures like Max Müller, the Philological Society, the universitization, as it were, of the study of language? What the Victorians recognize is that words mean more than they ever meant before. And what this phrase means is that the meaning of a word lies not in its representational ability, not in the way in which a word can describe the world, but the way in which a word has a history. In my earlier lectures, I've given you etymologies. I've given you histories of words. The stories that I've told are, to some degree, what the words are about. What matters is, in some sense, less and less what the word refers to in the world, and more what the word refers to in the history of language. This notion that words mean more than they ever meant before is, it seems to me, the compelling, the motivating pressure for the historical study of language, the formation of the Philological Society, and ultimately the decision on the part of the Philological Society to establish a new dictionary of the English language. This dictionary is, of course, called the New Dictionary because Johnson's dictionary, now a century old at this point, was the older dictionary. Indeed, it was the defining, if not the eponymous, dictionary of the English language. The OED was proposed to the Philological Society in 1857 as a way of establishing English etymology on a firmer or more scientific basis. And it was presented as a great linguistic symbol of national development. It, of course, took a long time for the OED to get rolling, as it were. The original editors, Richard Trench, Herbert Coleridge, were involved in the 1850s and 1860s with culling volunteers to get people to write down on scraps or slips of paper the meanings, the uses of words, and particularly illustrative literary quotations. As I mentioned, the Early English Text Society was established in order to provide reliable modern editions, modern in the 19th century sense of that term, reliable modern editions of earlier and in particular medieval texts so that the researchers for the OED could have reliable quotations. J.A.H. Murray, a Scottish schoolmaster and amateur philologist, was, in fact, finally chosen after the death and disaffection of several of the early editors to head up the OED project originally. And it is in 1879 that Murray officially takes over the Oxford English Dictionary and gets it rolling. But I'd like to look a little bit at some of the writings of the early founders of the OED to give us a sense of what their attitudes towards language were. Richard Trench, who was the original founder, claimed a true idea of his dictionary. He said, "A dictionary is an inventory of the language. It's the lexicographer's job to make that inventory, a job only if he can be the historian and not the critic of language." And he said, "It is no task of the maker of it to select the good words of a language." Now, what Trench is in effect doing is offering us a notion of lexicography as history. The job of the lexicographer is not, in the jokey words of Samuel Johnson, to be a harmless drudge. The job of the lexicographer is really to be an effective worker. Drudgery in 18th century humor becomes busyness in 19th century Victorian activity. And a figure like Trench conceives of the Dictionary of the Language as what one critic has called a historical monument to the history of a nation contemplated from one point of view. In this case, the point of view of language. What the Oxford English Dictionary does, and what it bequeaths not just to modern dictionaries, but to later 20th century discussions of language in the large, is the idea that the study of language is the study of a nation, that the study of language history is the study of the history of a people, and that the study of the etymologies of individual words is, in nuce, in little, the study of that history allegorically or emblematically. The legacy of the Oxford English Dictionary is therefore to be found not just in the ways in which words are organized on the page, but in the way in which we study, teach, and learn words and language. And I'd like to look at a clutch of quotations, four significant quotations from the 20th century that take these older 19th century discussions which look back to earlier 18th and ultimately 17th and 16th century discussions, and show us how, in our own period, issues of prescription and description, language, the dictionary, and the grammar book can understand the nature of culture, can give us senses of the relationship of language to society, of the role of authority and education in articulating that relationship, about questions of what is stylistically and what is grammatically appropriate. Are we describing or prescribing? And furthermore, I'd like you to think about these quotations. Do they challenge your own attitudes towards language use and the place of language? And finally, as I read them to you and discuss them, how are these, in some sense, models of style in their own right? To put it another way, are arbiters of language models for language use? And in reading what they say, are we also, perhaps unconsciously, following their forms? I want to begin with one of the most famous arbiters of language in the 20th century, and that's Henry Fowler, in his book Modern English Usage, the revised edition, and the article on grammar. Now, this is going to be a long quotation I'm going to read, but I want to pause over it to show how it fits into this historical narrative of grammar, style, prescription, and description, vernacular, and Latin. Now, Fowler says in his article on grammar, and I'm quoting, "We took a long time to realize that there's not much sense in trying to apply the rules of a dead synthetic language," by which he means Latin, to a living analytical one. You'll remember, by the way, that synthetic is a language that operates by creating meaning through case endings, and an analytic one is one where meaning is determined by the order of words in a sentence. Farrella goes on, perhaps we've not yet abandoned the attempt. It is, for instance, despite the grammarians, not thanks to them, that over the centuries our language has won ease and grace by getting rid of almost all its case inflections. I'm taking out my pencil and I'm underlining a phrase like ease and grace. Someday, perhaps, this good work will be complete. The good work now of the grammarian, a pastoralism. The grammarian as pastor, as preacher, justification by good works alone. And he goes on, and we shall no longer be faced with the sometimes puzzling task of choosing between who and whom. But is it going too far if we give the word grammar its proper meaning to say that grammar is of no importance as long as we make our meaning plain? And here he's going to refer to George Orwell, whose statements on language I'm going to close this lecture with. What are generally recognized for the time being as its conventions must be followed by those who would write clearly and agreeably, and its elements must be taught in the schools, if only as a code of good manners. This phenomenal statement, a definition of grammar, which goes from the historical to the present, which goes from the grammatical to the social, takes us back through all these 19th, 18th, 17th, and 16th century idioms and forms and ideologies. Ease and grace. Now, the Johnsonian aesthetics of language study. Discussions about Latin and English takes us back to Loth and Priestley. Should we use Latin or should we use English grammar? The debate on who and whom takes us back to was and wert in Loth. And this notion of convention as opposed to rule, of clarity and agreeability, as if being clear and being agreeable was both a grammatical and a social virtue. One goes to a party to be clear and agreeable. One writes in order to be clear and agreeable. Its elements must be taught in the schools. What are the elements of language? A word like elements takes us back to Euclid's Elements, the very first, perhaps, textbook of the study of the world, if only as a code of good manners. Propriety now in its 18th century sense as both an issue of grammar and an issue of behavior. Common sense for Locke became good sense for Fanny Burney, good manners now in Fowler's Modern English Usage. If you turn to a modern American dictionary, like Webster's New World Dictionary of the English Language, you look up language in the dictionary, which is a marvelous introduction to how to use the volume. And there you get the following statement. Language rests upon use. Anything used long enough by enough people will become standard. A good dictionary can promote order in inevitable growth. It will also promote stability in the language by preserving evidence of the past, but it should not be treated mainly as a means to ensure linguistic atrophy. Look at the language here. This is profoundly Johnsonian in its tone. Johnson had talked about how men age and die, and he used this organicist metaphor to register the possibilities of being, as it were, unable to form and fix a language. Men grow old and die, languages change. Remember, he also talked about the lexicographer as someone who should not embalm the language. Look now in Webster at a kind of anatomy of lexicography. A good dictionary can promote order in inevitable growth. Now, the idea is that the dictionary is something like a hedge clipper. Let's promote order in inevitable growth. Let's have a sense of the landscape here, and let's prune and trim a little bit. Let's promote order in inevitable growth. Stability to preserve evidence in the past, but it should not be treated as a means to ensure linguistic atrophy. The body, the landscape, the world. This seemingly common sense phrasing that I've just read you is in its own way charged with notions of politics and power. A good dictionary can promote order and inevitable growth. There is almost a kind of paternalism to this quality here. Stability, order, these are idioms which show the dictionary, as it were, sitting on the fence between prescriptivism and descriptivism. Any act of describing will inevitably be an act of prescribing. And when we open a major modern dictionary and see something of common sense, what we're really seeing is good sense, what we're really seeing is good manners. Let's move on. The American scholar and Harvard teacher Douglas Bush was a major figure in the mid-20th century in the study of the Renaissance and in the arbitrations of language use and scholarship. And in the Journal of the American Scholar, published in an article, published in 1972 in this journal, Bush argued for the nature of language and change. And here's his quotation. "We know that language is always changing and growing, but acceptance of the perpetual process does not, nor should not, mean blind surrender to the moment of inertia of slovenly and tasteless ignorance and insensitivity." Bush as a kind of late 20th century Alexander Gill. What shall we underline here? Slovenly and tasteless ignorance and insensitivity. As if the very notion now of propriety is being transferred back. As if illiteracy were to be represented by bad hygiene as well as bad behavior. Tasteless ignorance and insensitivity, a kind of anti-sartorialism of linguistic use. Ideally, Bush goes on, changes should be inaugurated from above by the masters of language, like Douglas Bush, not from below. From the Greeks, notably Plato, he says, and the Romans onward, many men of goodwill have been concerned about the use and abuse of language, and they did what they could to curb barbarism and foster taste, discipline, and integrity. Where are we in this world? Are we in the world of Alexander Gill? Are we in the world of William Loth? Or are we in the world of the 1970s? Let's, as it were, historicize this passage. What is the politics of legislating language? The barbarians are at the gate. The revolution is here. And the job of, as it were, the masters of language is to curb barbarism and foster taste, discipline, and integrity. In this brief passage is not just an attitude towards language, but the story of social upheaval, of revolution, of threat, and of change. Just as Joseph Priestley in the 1770s could write about the genius of a free nation, could talk about language and freedom in a particularly revolutionary context. So, in the early 1970s, 2 centuries later, Douglas Bush, one of the self-identified masters of language, could talk about barbarism, taste, discipline, and integrity. Reading this passage leads one to assume, perhaps, that Bush's attitude is, if only they could spell correctly. If only they really did know the difference between who and whom, they'd dress a little better. They'd cut their hair. They'd take a bath. They'd come to class. If only we could, as it were, give us and give them a sense of order and stability, and somehow efface the slovenly and tasteless ignorance that is besetting our time. Discussions of language are invariably discussions of culture and politics, whether they be of the 1970s, or of the 1870s, or of the 1770s. I want to conclude this lecture, and I want to conclude this second set of the 3 sets of lectures on the history of the English language, with one of the most well-known disquisitions on language in the 20th century. This is George Orwell's Politics and the English Language, an extended essay of the 1940s, and I'm going to read a passage from it. "In our time," he says, "political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan, can be indeed defended by only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face, and which do not square with the professed aims of political parties. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. Defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population or rectification of frontiers. People are imprisoned for years without trial, or shot in the back of the neck, or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology is needed if one wants to name things without calling up mental pictures of them. This powerful and profound statement, as powerful for the late 1940s as it was to me in the 1970s when I was a student, and as it is for us today at the close of the 20th century, is a statement about language, power, politics, and history. In our time, he begins. In our time, three words that must, in Orwell's time, have resonated with those terrible prophetic statements of 1939. Peace in our time. Appeasement. A peace that, in fact, did not come in our time. The defense of the indefensible. Take us back to Samuel Johnson, who in a famous phrase once called patriotism the last refuge of scoundrels. This opening up of the cracks and fissures of the patriotic. Things like the continuance of British rule in India. How is that a thing? How does Orwell use his language to make political statement? Continuance of British rule in India. Russian purges and deportations, dropping of atom bombs on Japan. These are all events that are described here in polysyllabic words. Words that are borrowed, loan words in English. Continuance. Go back to Middle English, and the A-N-C-E words are always French. Chaucer, continuance. Russian purge, purgation from the Latin, deportation, another major Latin word here. But these are things, a word from Old English. Orwell is so sensitive and aware to the resources of his own language that he can, much like Chaucer centuries before him, oppose the Old English and the imported, to give us now a landscape in which English words just simply can't describe the horror of the world. He talks about euphemism. What is the etymology of euphemism? Euphemism comes from a work published in the 1580s by a man named John Lilly, who wrote a long book called Euphues, which is a book about rhetoric and education. And Euphues loves inkhorn terms and aureate diction. The first euphemisms are the inkhorn words. A euphemism today, and this is central to understanding Orwell as it is central to understanding ourselves, a euphemism today is not simply a polite way of expressing something else. It is, it seems to me, invariably a polysyllabic loan word way of expressing something. We do not say death. We do not say kill. We say pacification. What's euphemistic about this word is its length, its foreignness, its Latinity, its spill from the inkhorn of mid-20th century diplomatics. Protocol, transfer of population, rectification of frontiers, elimination of unreliable elements. Such phraseology for Orwell is phraseology, for we are no longer in the world of words, we are in the world of phrases. We are not in the wordum or word of Old English, but in the phrase of Latin. It seems to me that in closing this second set of lectures, Orwell gives us not just evidence of how language can be used politically, but how the very etymologies of words carry with them political stories. The Victorians recognized, as I suggested at the beginning of this lecture, that words mean more than we ever thought they did. What I hope to have shown in these first two parts, and what I hope to continue to show in part three, concentrating on the development of American English, is how, in fact, words always tell us more than we thought they meant. In looking at the native and the loan, in looking at the blunt statement and the euphemism, in looking at the proprieties of grammar and the proprieties of behavior, we see the politics and ideology of language. We see in each word a story not just of the culture and the country, but the self and the identity. As we move beyond the expression of the everyday to the articulation of the strange, the alien, and the exotic. Until next time, when we look at American English, I leave you not with pacification, not with phraseology, but with word and world. Thank you.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. Thank you for listening to these lectures from the Superstar Teachers series. We hope you enjoyed them as much as we did. To receive a copy of our latest catalog or to order more courses, please give us a call at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12.